This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on May 22nd, 2016. I am Mike Rappin, your host. With me this week are two fantastic people, Tia Vasiliou.
Hi.
And Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
I'm super excited that both of them are here with me this week. This week's topic is going to cover all things fan fiction, specifically around comic books, but we are going to be talking about fan fiction on the whole. But before we get to that, we are actually going to be talking about comic books and what we're excited to read this week and what we read in the past week. So, Tia, do you want to get us started with that?
Sure. In my ongoing attempt to read a little more broadly and get out of my little Marvel bubble, this week I read The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, number 5, which, whoa, I was not expecting so much Satanism in a Sabrina book. But it was awesome. Like, I have no objection to that. It's like, if you like cheerleaders and Satan and talking cats and raising the dead, I got a book for you.
I mean, who doesn't love those things?
It's so wonderful.
It was so good. So, as far as I can tell, like, Sabrina and Betty and Veronica are in a coven or something, and
sure,
they're like raising the dead. They're like raising the dead, and you know that never goes according to plan. So I'll be picking up the next issue for sure to find out how that plays out. I'm guessing not well. Yeah. And I also read, this was like kind of a nostalgia hit for me, Tank Girl, Two Girls, One Tank, number 1. Now, I know that some Tank Girl purists might not be interested because the art is by Brett Parson instead of Jamie Hewlett. So just like, you guys, chill the fuck out. Just like, give it a chance. It's, the art is still pretty great, and it has definitely the Tank Girl feel that you're looking for. But it is a little bit more mainstream, and but it's still really enjoyable. And basically, Tank Girl's tank has been stolen and acquired by an art gallery. And the the woman who runs the art gallery decides to become Tank Girl. So the real Tank Girl is like not thrilled that her tank is missing, and she's off to look for it. And there is some strong indication that this art gallerist might be someone who Tank Girl already knows and has lost her memory or something. I don't know. So if you've been a Tank Girl fan, I think that this is a nice sort of visit down memory lane, and definitely worth a read.
So to interrupt really quick, for those of us such as myself who haven't really read any Tank Girl, could you give us a brief overview of what that series is?
Oh, sure. So it's kind of a post-apocalyptic sort of situation, and Tank Girl is this extraordinarily profane, brazen, brassy chick who lives in a tank, and she has a kangaroo boyfriend named Booga, and they basically just go around and like break the fourth wall and swear and drink and have sex and blow stuff up. It's really great.
That's awesome. Okay. That's kind of what I thought it was, but I just wanted to make sure.
She's got all kinds of cool friends, actually. Like, there's Jet Girl, and there's Sub Girl, and there's a whole cast of crazy characters, and it's just, it's really fun and vulgar and sort of anarchist, which is, yeah. I mean, you could get into, there's a whole history that is tied to, like, you know, the serious counterculture from the late 80s and 90s. And of course, there's that movie that people love to hate. I actually just enjoy it from the mid 90s, I think, that has Lori Petty in it.
I've never seen this.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
I'm so out of the loop.
Yeah. I mean, I still listen to the soundtrack, even. Like, the soundtrack is really good. It's just fun. When I was younger, when I was probably 12, Tank Girl is the first comic that I ever picked up. I don't know why my mother let me, because it's not for 12-year-olds. And I really wanted to be Tank Girl. I tried to dress like Tank Girl.
That's awesome.
And I mean, honestly, she was the first anti-heroine that I ever really was exposed to, and really, I was just enamored with this idea that she wasn't beautiful and she didn't give a fuck. And I just really needed that kind of role model in my life mm-hmm. at age mm-hmm. 12. So so I'm really excited that there's this, you know, art gallery lady who's becoming Tank Girl, because I used to be an art historian. So like,
right.
this book is literally about me, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah. And another thing that I read is Tomb Raider number 4, which, again, you know, I have this past life as an academic. And so I really was going into reading Tomb Raider kind of apprehensively, because I'm like, okay, she's this like scantily clad archaeologist who tomb raids. That sounds terrible. But in the comics, and apparently there was a run right before this that kind of set up this characterization of her, where she actually is a very competent academic with a lot of field and fighting training. So they establish her character. She's not a strong female character. She has friends and she has relationships and she has more complexity than a strong female character. But she is strong for reasons that make a lot of sense to her character and to her story. And she mm-hmm. is female, mm-hmm. which is awesome. So if you like adventure comics and you're into well-written female protagonists, definitely check out Tomb Raider.
Cool. Cool. And I believe you also had a review for this on the Mary Sue this past week, right?
I did, in fact, yes, in which I request that people who are more familiar with the character help me out a little bit, because I didn't know who everybody was, and I've never played the games, but I'm super interested. So, like, if you check out the article on the Mary Sue, leave me a comment and let me know which comics or games you think I should check out, because I'm super interested.
Yeah, I'll throw a link to that in the show notes for anyone that's interested.
Thanks.
Kate, what did you read this past week?
Not much. I read two trades for a minisode that I recorded with Nick that will be on in a few months, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Mike.
Sometime soon. We're not really sure, but hopefully sometime in July, fingers crossed.
Yeah. So they weren't my usual types of book, and they weren't really my jam. It was Divinity and The Valiant.
Okay.
And then I also read Vision number 7, which is 100% my jam, and it was awesome. This one is the first book of the new arc. And it's with the guest artist, Michael Walsh, who I'm not a huge fan of the art style, but it works really well with the entire issue being a flashback, having it be a different artist.
Mm-hmm.
And it was another really great issue with a lot of good reveals that then set up a new direction for the story, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really excited to read that book in trade when it comes out.
Yes, it's amazing. And I believe the first trade came out, but I want to wait and see. I'm hoping that they'll do an hardcover omnibus of it, since it's only 12 issues.
That's what I'm hoping for as well.
Yeah, I've been getting it in digital, so I want a big thing that I can put on my shelf and look at and feel good. My favorite this week, though, was Civil War 2, issue 0, was a pleasant surprise. Mm-hmm. So the art is... Okay, I'm going to mispronounce.
Coypel.
I don't think it's Oliver, though. I think it's Olivier, because it has an IE.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I'm not even going to try with that last name. And then colorist Justin Ponzer, and they are like a fantastic art team that I don't think I've seen anywhere before. And that was, I think, like 75% of why I really liked the issue. But the rest of it, as for a zero issue, it was for a summer event. It was actually logical and didn't feel forced or setup-y at all, even though it does set up the event really well. And so it sets up Captain Marvel as having been burned pretty badly by these catastrophic events and wanting to prevent them altogether and kind of feeling like very out of control. And so she wants to put the horse before the cart, if you will. And then it sets up She-Hulk as being really burned in the fight for free will and everything and wanting to preserve freedom of thought and whatnot. And then War Machine gets offered the Secretary of Defense to prevent Tony from ultimately buying the presidency. So topical.
Oh, man.
Trump. And then we also meet Ulysses, the guy who becomes the Inhuman with precognitive powers, I believe, that is going to be, you know, the fighting piece for this whole thing.
Interesting.
So, yeah, and so it got me psyched for the event more than I have been and was actually an interesting read. And I was pretty dreading pretty hard the tie-ins to Captain Marvel. You know how sometimes your series gets ruined by horrible tie-ins issues? And now they actually fit. At least it seems to be fitting with her story so far and the character and everything. And so I'm not too worried about it now, so that's good news.
That's exciting, only because I was absolutely dreading Civil War II. Mostly because I'm a jerkwad and I hold to the original Civil War, no matter how bad it is in some ways. So.
But this doesn't try and redo it. It's a completely right. different concept and with different characters. And where they had the boys duking it out for Civil War, now the girls get a chance. So that's awesome.
Yeah. I've only heard that, I mean, I think from you as well as other people online saying the same thing. So maybe it's not going to be so bad. Who knows?
But if anything, it's only 6 issues, Mike.
I know.
I mean, I think that it makes sense that in a community as large as the Marvel superhero community, there would be a lot of factious fighting about the best way to go about their superheroing.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, for me, what I read this past week was I read a lot of my digital comic books that have been just piling up and piling up. I managed to push through Uncanny X-Men number 7 and All-New X-Men number 9, where they're starting this new Apocalypse Wars summer event, because the X-Men need a summer event as well. What I thought was really interesting is that these two books are approaching the Apocalypse event separately, which is really unique, and I kind of dig it, because they're one side is about all about Warren, the other Warren Worthington, Angel, and the other side is about not Warren Worthington. It's really bizarre. So I'm pretty excited about that. Rye number 13 was a fantastic tie-in to 4001 AD. We're getting a lot of history in the Valiant universe about Rye as a character. And if you're not reading any Valiant books, that's okay. This book made me feel so bad for robots, I like wanted to cry.
Oh my God.
So I have to credit Matt Kent for that. And Cafu's art was way better than I could have ever expected. Like, I love Clayton Crane's art, and he's doing the 4001 AD book, which I think is a 4-issue miniseries, like the primary event book. And Rye is like one of the supplementary books that are happening, as well as tie-ins to Eternal Warrior, Bloodshot, and Exo Man of War. And if I got any of those wrong, I'm going to hear it from Nick this week, so that's great. But nonetheless, this book was beautiful, and I love Rye as a character. Like, of all the Valiant books, Rye is my favorite, and it's continuing to be fantastic. I don't know how Matt Kent continues to write such high quality books, just given how many books he's actually writing. So really excited for this event. I read All New Wolverine number 8 just before the show, and I've decided that this book is the most perfectly paced comic book out there. I read through the entire series without realizing that I was done. Like, it's one of those books, like watching a really good movie where you're like, oh, it's over. So much happened. How did this? It felt like no time had passed at all. So this book is wonderful. Also because Laura's clone sister, who I'm considering a sister now, actually has a pet Wolverine from All New Wolverine number 7, where Squirrel Girl showed up. So like, that Wolverine is now part of the story. I'm so happy that that's a thing. I also read this Comixology Submit book, continuing on my trek of reading Comixology Submit books. It's called Petrichor. It was like a 20-page art book, kind of. Like, there was a story that happened, but it was just really beautiful art with almost no story. Or if there was a story, like, maybe I didn't catch on to it. I might need to reread it. But it was just, it was really slow, and it felt like it was the beginning of a, like, larger story. And all of a sudden, it just ended. So I was a little disappointed in that. But this is the first book out of probably, like, 8 or 10 that I've read in the past couple of weeks that I've not really liked so much. So I think that's a pretty good record. Well, finally, the big thing that I read was Future Quest number 1, and it's the most exciting, campy book that you could ever read, and I hate it for being so campy, but I love it because Doc Shaner's art is beautiful, and Jeff Parker's writing is completely on point, and I think I'm also in love with it because I'm currently rewatching the Venture Bros TV show, and Venture Bros is like a clone parody of what this story is about. Like, all the characters, Space Ghost and I don't even know what, Johnny Quest and Dr. Quest, and it's so ridiculous. Like, Future Quest is way out there and campy and corny, and I think I'm going to have to read this book to its end. It's so good. So I don't know if you guys read that at all, but that was like the one book that I took a chance on, and now I'm hooked, and I have to add another book to my pull list. So
that's what you get for trying new things.
I know, damn it. but speaking of pull lists, what are you guys reading this week that you're excited for? We'll jump back to Kate.
I'm most excited this week for Captain Marvel number 5. We're looking at the end of the first arc here. Number 6 will start the Civil War tie-ins. And I'm excited just to see what happens. We're at the point where she's depowered, and obviously she has to be repowered for the event, so we'll see how that works out. And to kind of get a resolution for all this. Ultimately, I'm less excited now about this arc than I was at the beginning, because as much as I love Michelle Fizikas, I'm not going to pronounce this right, and Tara Butter's writing, they really ultimately played it really safe. I like that we have a lot of female characters interacting with one another about things like space fighting instead of boys, but they've fallen into the pretty tired gal pal character ruts. Like, there's the smart one and the spunky one and the strict one, and they're, you know, where the girl's biggest character flaw is, you know, following the rules too closely, you know, that kind of really lame, not exciting character flaws that we get with female characters all the time. And I just really want us to have characters with real flaws instead of blemishes. You know, let's have them have real fights, not little misunderstandings that we can talk through in an issue and safely resolve. So, you know, real women with real female interactions, which I think is kind of what we got promised at the beginning of this, of their run, that we had two great female writers on this book that were going to give us that. And I don't think it ultimately panned out. The best part at this point of each issue is Matt Wilson's colors are as vibrant and gorgeous and beautiful that as man. Ever. He's just so perfect. And it works so well with this book, with the different, you know, space battles and everything. And Anka and Smith's art is still good too. So he's coloring really well drawn stuff, but man, I swear he could color my pencil drawing, like my stick figures, and they'd look amazing.
He could color a stick figure into like the freaking highest form of art that you could imagine.
It's insane. Yeah. So I guess that's not the highest like recommendation for a book that I'm most excited about, but not a lot's coming out this week for me. So that's where I'm at. How about you?
Tia, what are you excited for this week?
Well, last time I was on the show, I talked about my first foray into the Valiant universe with Divinity 2, and I really loved it. And I've been eagerly anticipating the second issue of Divinity 2, which comes out next week, and I'm really excited. I just love the art. I love the concept, and I'm really interested to see how they're going to use this woman character to play out the ideas of divinity and sacrifice, and I don't know. I think that even though the writing and the art team seem to be pretty dude, they're comprised by mainly dudes here, I have a lot of faith in them that they're going to give us a nuanced look at this character. So I am very excited about it.
That's another Matt Kent book. How does this guy do it?
I know, right? Yeah. Did you read Divinity, Tia?
No, I didn't. I looked it up just to kind of get the gist. And I probably will go back and read it. What did you?
It's only four issues, yeah. So it's not much to go back and read.
Yeah.
I don't know the thing that. So I've recently
we have wildly different tastes. I will say that.
Yeah. Throw that out there. But the thing that rubs me the wrong way with so many of these books is they're Valiant's big on like, okay, let's get some characters of color, which is awesome. But they don't actually write characters of color. They just color them. If you know what I mean, like it's still.
Yes. Yeah.
And that is very much Divinity, where it's like, oh, he's African American or whatever, but then he's totally not. It's just in color, and then it's that kind of thing really rubs me the wrong way.
Is he African American or is he Russian?
He's Russian.
He's both.
Black.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's what I meant. Ugh. Yeah. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
That's a, no,
but
no,
anyway.
That's
a... Well, because I mean, I think that, I don't know. I mean, I totally get, yeah, that's a problem. But I also wonder, like, what would be the important differences in, like, what we would expect of an African-American character versus a Soviet-era Black Russian character.
Right. Like, would you even really know? But the thing that gets me is it's kind of pervasive through at least all the books that I've read that in Valiant, which I'll throw that out there. It's not very many, but I don't know. And then there's so obviously I tend to read more female centric books. And one of the things with the Valiant verse that bugs me so much, which as Nick points out constantly, it's not like it's better at some other publishers. But when you have just like an entire verse populated by dudes and there's like three women and you're like,
That is the one thing that I would definitely say Valiant has a problem with, but they are actively trying to fix by establishing the currently existing characters and then like introducing new characters to say, like, here, we're actually going to like flesh this universe out with like as many representations as we possibly can.
Oh, which I mean,
makes you kind of think, like, why didn't you do that from the beginning? And that's always been the thing that people knock them on online. So it's a hard balance, I think, because they have to, you're sure, trying to appeal to people that knew about Valiant way back in the day, while also, I don't know, it's the constant, do we appeal to old readers or new readers? And who knows, right?
Yeah, and credit where credit's due, they're also giving us faith, and they just announced the faith ongoing. So, like, they're obviously not awful. But just when I've been reading the team-up books with them, I'm like, okay, huge number of dudes, and then this one Livewire girl, who I didn't realize was female until Nick told me because of the way she was drawn in The Valiant. But that aside.
Well, one of the things that I really am interested in with Divinity is that seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first Divinity character was dealing a lot more with like the implication of his powers for his personal relationships in a way, whereas it seems very much like Valentina does not have personal relationships, nor does she care about having personal relationships.
Yeah, I think from what I've read of Divinity 2, what it's about, it sounds actually more interesting. Coming at it from like a societal level and how she's essentially the embodiment of Soviet Russia.
Right, exactly. Which is called the motherland. Right. You know what I mean?
Right, so exactly.
You know, so I think that there's a lot of gender issues they can explore here, and I think that it's subversive to switch those, because usually when you have a character who's dealing with their personal relationships, it's the woman.
That's true. Yeah. And it's not often that you see a male character struggling with like personal loss to that extent, and that's what you get in Divinity. So, yeah.
Well, maybe I'll pick up those four before Wednesday, and then I'll just have a whole front-loaded week of Divinity to read.
I mean, I really like Divinity, but that's, you know, that's just me, I guess. Well, I'm gonna steal the thunder here and go talk about what I'm reading this week, and what I'm excited for is Jonesy number 4, which is the final issue of this miniseries by Sam Humphries and Caitlin Rose Boyle. And as I've said many times before, this is the most fun book you can read. It's goofy. It's exciting. Like, it's really easy to read, like, and not in a bad way. In like, there's no complex relationships. It's just like a lot of fun and goofy humor, and I kind of enjoy that. Like, it's a very nice palate cleanser to get away from all the serious stoic everything that, you know, comic books usually are. And I shouldn't say that like all of my comic books are like that, because I also read Jughead today, and that's all about a guy who just loves hamburgers. So this book has been a lot of fun, and apparently the story for this week's issue, or this month's issue, is that Jonesy is going to run into someone who has the same love powers that she does. And if you don't know anything about this book, Jonesy has the ability to compel people to love things or other people. It's really wild.
And also, like, ideas, right?
And concepts, which they established last issue.
Like, I think I read the last one. Is that the one where she wants to get a tattoo?
Yes, that's the issue. Yeah, she wants to get a tattoo. Yeah. This book constantly makes me laugh, and I really enjoy when a book can do that, and it's not super meta. It's just a comic book that's a fun, all-ages story. Like, throwing back to what we talked about last week, this is another example of a really good all-ages book. If you're willing to, you know, give up the idea that maybe these aren't adult problems, these are like teenager problems or middle schooler problems, but it's still a lot of fun. You know,
whatever, it's still relatable. We can all remember that time.
Exactly. So this book is, I'm really excited for the end of this book. Although I'm sad to see it go, it's nice to have a mini series that just concludes. You can go, this is a good comic book that I can put on my shelf and recommend to others. So it's going to be fun.
I gotta say, this is one that I had zero interest in when I first read the preview stuff about it. Mm-hmm. And from your talking about it the last few months, I've put it on my list of stuff to look for and trade. So,
cool. It's really good. I mean, the art is maybe a little off-putting, but it kind of reminds me of like an Adventure Time or of a Scott Pilgrim in a way.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I get a Brian Lee O'Malley vibe off it.
Totally. But it's very good. I really like it. As a byproduct of our great, great, great debate, way back where we talked about restaging comics, and I highly suggest you go listen to that because it's a fantastic episode. Tia and Kate approached me about this idea of talking about fan fiction, and kind of as a combination of my, I guess, humorous jabbings about how I don't really dig fan fiction, how I'm not a big fan of it, they wanted to actually do an actual episode about it. So after multiple schedule conflicts and rearranging things to make things happen, T and K are here to actually talk about fan fiction, like I said at the top of the show. And I don't really have a direction about this, I guess, how to start this topic outside of saying I'm not a fan of fan fiction, and I can't really put my finger on why. So I guess I want to pitch it to you to say, you know, what's the deal with fan fiction? What makes fan fiction so great?
Before we start, I think it would be helpful to define our terms here, because people who aren't familiar with fan fiction, I think, sometimes have the mistaken idea that all of it is sexual in nature, which it is not. Fan fiction that is sexual in nature or and there's a difference between fan fiction that has sex in it and that is specifically being written for, yeah, the smut factor. But that's typically referred to as slash fic.
Okay, okay.
And so I just want to make sure that people are aware of that not all fan fiction is slash fiction.
Right. It just usually associated together because when we're trying to talk about something negatively, we're obviously going to bring up the most ridiculous part of that thing, or what we perceive as the most ridiculous part of that thing, right?
Right. But it'd be like saying all movies are porn when clearly they're two completely different things, even though they're utilizing the same visual medium. Yeah, it's totally different.
But yeah, I mean, I guess my confusion about your problem with fan fiction, like, at this point, no one writing X-Men invented X-Men. So why is that, in your mind, okay, but people who are writing it without the support of the publisher is not okay?
I think a lot of part of that comes down to, I hate to say this about comic books because the Big Two is the worst place in the entire world to make this claim, but the idea of one consistent continuity seems like to be an understood thing. Like it's licensed, it's A-okayed, it's fallen under this umbrella of this is the story. You know, like if a movie came out and then there were 10 different versions of that movie, how would you know, like, what is the movie? Like, what is the story that you're supposed to understand in order to get the context of everything else? I think, like, having one single story that defines, you know, how characters are written, how characters are perceived, I guess, and not necessarily perceived, but how characters, like, act and interact with other characters. Like, there needs to be, like, in my mind, there needs to be, you know, one way in which those characters are written and told. And if that changes within that same umbrella and that confine, that's fine because it is, like, sanctioned in a way.
I guess is it that hard to tell them, keep them apart in your mind, though? I mean, like, if I read a Black Widow comic and then I read a Black Widow fan fiction that clearly isn't congruent with the current timeline or the way she's currently portrayed, it doesn't tarnish one or the other. I just don't see the overlap there.
Yeah, like, they can coexist. It's not hard.
Yeah, exactly. One doesn't negate the other, and it's not confusing. I guess I can see it if you spend, like, hours and hours reading a certain type of timeline or whatever in one form, and then the other, you kind of have to keep reminding yourself that this wasn't part of the one or the, and it goes both ways. I currently am in this boat for Game of Thrones, and having been reading too much fan fiction where it's taking the same characters and putting them in the 1920s, which is super cool and I highly recommend, but then you have to go back and remind yourself that one has dragons and one has bankers.
Well, so. And also I think that any good fan fiction is really synthesizing the canon and using what's there to expand on it. So even if you are reading a 1920s alternate universe version, if it's well written, the author is showing their work in a way, because what they're doing is they're showing that they understand the canon and the continuity and the characterization in such a really granular way that they can actually take it and put it in a separate universe and explore other things about it that maybe are not going to fit into the main storylines, but they complement them in that they're bringing out different threads or showing you different sides of what the characters are capable of.
Mm-hmm. I think that is so well said and goes with the Game of Thrones thing so well, because so much of what I read is about the female characters that are just super one-dimensional the way that George R. R. Martin has written them a lot of times, and are tend to be there more as plot devices at points. But even when they're not as fleshed out as their male counterparts. And so you get the fan fiction that really understands them and writes it well. And so it's not like they're more, it's more building on the same and adding adding the different facets.
But in that same vein, though, doesn't that become confusing? I mean, like, if a character is written one way in a fan fiction that you like, but they're not portrayed that way on the show, then aren't you just a fan of that fan fiction and not of the show or comic book or whatever it may be?
You know what? It's interesting that you bring that up, because I can think of two instances, like, immediately where fandom imagination has literally just, like, been superimposed onto canon. One is that Kate Bishop is Asian. I read Kate Bishop as Asian now, regardless of how she's drawn, purely mm-hmm. because of the fan art and fan casting and fan fiction that is just, like, we've all just collectively agreed on that. And the other one, yeah. And the other one is canonically bisexual Steve Rogers. Like, that's a thing. I'm sorry. It just is.
You can see it in the movies.
And you know what? There is an important point about fan culture, which is that straight white masculine engagement with fandom tends to be more connoisseurial, which is kind of what you're talking about, Mike. It's more interested in cataloging what is there. And that's because probably their identities are represented in that canon. And so queer, non-white, feminine engagement with fandom tends to be a little more transformative, like fan works and headcanons and so forth, because their identities are not necessarily represented in the canon as frequently or as well.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you there. I mean, I you know, we've obviously, you know, and I think in the last like 5 or so years, you know, made that, I think that's a very apparent thing, and I think some publishers are trying to fix that. Whether they're doing that well or not is not really for me to decide. Seeing that I, you know, don't identify as that, seeing it being a straight white male and everything's catered to me, so I can't really say whether or not that things have been getting better, but at the same time, like, there is no argument for me here. Like, I can't argue that is a thing that has gotten better or has changed. And if fan fiction allows people to, you know, take those stories or write different stories to, you know, to allow them to better identify with these characters, that's great. But isn't the actual solution to try to fix the current story rather than, I don't know, take the ideas that already exist and then transform them to your own ideals?
How about we do both? Why do they have to be mutually exclusive?
Going back to my original statement, I think that it's important to have, I think it's important to have one strict storyline about, you know, certain characters. And yes, there may be alternate universes where characters, you know, appear different or act different or are not alive or dead or have different relationships with other people, but that's still under the umbrella. I mean, I think we're strictly talking about big two comics at this point, but that's still under the umbrella of like sanctioned, like approved storylines that are being pushed out. And now we can probably get into the argument about, well, the people that are running these businesses aren't people that, you know, you can necessarily identify if you are if you aren't a straight white man. But at the same time, that's like a systematic problem, and I want to talk more about, you know, the actual stories themselves, I guess.
To be honest with you, Mike, I mean, I do get what you're saying, like that it's nice to have a single continuity, but why does it have to be the publisher sanctioned one? For example, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I basically disavow that Age of Ultron exists because it's a piece of garbage and I don't want it in my continuity. Mm-hmm. I have substituted it with any number of delightful fan fictions that seamlessly like fit into that space and make a much happier experience for me with my engagement with those movies. So I guess I don't necessarily disagree with you that it's important to have a linear engagement, I guess, if that's something that is really important to you. But why does it have to be the one that they're making? Like, they're grooming you to be a consumer. Their concerns here are making money, not about like making you happy. You need to make yourself happy. So like, if what they're giving you isn't making you happy, but this other thing is, and it just exists for you to engage with however you choose on your own terms, then like, why not?
I'd also argue that fan fiction, especially transformative fanfic, that it is in a way the way that the publishers get pressured to make changes, because it is one way of many that fans can push back and say we want more of this or of that. So as much as I agree that we need to see the changes at, you know, a commercial level, until then, here's an awesome alternative. And B, this is also part of that change and that transformation.
Great point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I don't know how well received fan fiction is to publishers or TV shows, movies, whatever, you know, you're necessarily
I'm guessing writing not about very.
Or drawing. And but there, I think there's a specific reason for that, right? Going, you know, if you go to a convention, you know, and you have a script ready for a comic, or, you know, you've written a short story or you've written something, editors and publishers and writers, they refuse to take them. They won't take them. They won't read them because they don't want to run into the issue where if you wrote something and then a story that gets published in the future is a very similar story to what you wrote, that they could draw the connection to say, oh, well, you ripped off this person and they weren't licensed to write these characters. So in a way, I don't know if fan fiction can really accomplish that. You know what I mean? And at the same time, I feel like in some ways fan fiction kind of, I think it devalues published work. Like, people, you know, have to fight tooth and nail to break into the comic book industry. And as soon as you start saying, well, I don't like the way that you do this, I'm going to do it my way, aren't you just saying that like their work is worth nothing?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think that what we're saying is you are being paid by this company to write these characters in a certain framework that is approved by the publisher because they want to make money. And that doesn't necessarily map onto fan fiction. The whole point of fan fiction is that you're just writing what you want and you're reading what you want. And so I think that the idea of value as it pertains to fan fiction, it doesn't necessarily line up one-to-one with canon, because the value is literally just in the joy of reading and writing it. There isn't the transactional nature of purchasing work from some... I don't know, like, right. It's more free in that way.
Well, and I think that comes to a good point, is like the value then is in the entertainment value. And if you don't find it fun to read and interesting and all that stuff, Mike, then maybe fan fiction for you has no value. But that doesn't mean it has no value as a thing in and of itself. You know what I mean? Like, I have zero interest in most adult cartoon type stuff. Like, I like Bob Busburgers. That's a bad example, but that's one I think can think of, you know. But most of them, I'm like, why is this even a thing? But it doesn't mean it's bad, because I know, you know, almost all my friends love it, which is why I'm exposed to it so much and go, oh. But you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean it doesn't have value just because I don't enjoy it. And so it might not be something you seek out, but it doesn't mean it's bad that it exists. I don't think it's insulting. And I think also when characters are written well and there's... That is almost a when there's more fan fiction, and it's almost a compliment to the writers.
People want more.
Exactly. That it's like when there's a new book coming out, but we have to wait 2 years, you'll see a huge flood of fan fiction to fill that gap because people are so desperate for more stories about their characters. And the same thing in comics, like when Batgate happened and the creators like walked off because they couldn't, the DC said, Kate Kane and Maggie Story couldn't get married, there was a huge flood of fan fiction about their wedding. And I think that was a huge compliment and support of the creators.
Right. Yeah. And I can see that, like, when a story doesn't go the way that the majority of fans thought it should have, like, that's like an injustice to the fans, right? But I think that what we're almost talking about is like free entertainment when we should also be supporting these comics and these stories at the same time. Like, I understand that it's all about, it's a consumerism, blah de blah, and stuff like that, where we are consumers and we're being sold stories and we have to pay for them, but people are,
they, you know, literally they just pulled TV shows because they skewed too female. They don't want us, and they make that very clear.
You have these things like, yeah, that we can't have. We were just talking before the show. We can't have a female villain because it won't sell toys to little boys, apparently, is what they think. And that we, yeah, that there's just the faith that the publisher knows the way the continuity should go and is going to do the story the right way, I think is something that you can hold, because it does go the way of, like you were saying, like white cisgender men, like that, it fits, and so it's okay. And yeah,
I guess what I was trying to get at was that, like, we still have to support these creators. I mean, not to say that you have to pay for a comic book simply because it exists. There's no way, no, I'm not trying to say that, but if it sounds like there was at one point an argument for, like, free entertainment, and I don't think that that is necessarily the right way. Like, that's the opposite extreme, I think, of paying for everything.
You'd be hard-pressed to find someone creating fan fiction that isn't also buying and consuming the licensed stuff, though. Again, it's not mutually exclusive. In order to write good fanfic or draw good fanfic, you have to know the character, really, the canon character, really well, mm-hmm. to be able to play with it in your own hands, kind of thing. And yeah, no, and I mean, even for just consumers of fan fiction, I think if you're really into certain characters, you also read them in both forms. You know what I mean? Like, I love reading Black Widow fan fiction, and I also love reading Black Widow comics.
And I think it's also less an issue of free entertainment as it is, no one is paying me to write this. So I can literally write anything that I want. I'm not beholden to anybody. If two people read it, then great. If 200 people read it, cool. It's not about selling something. It's about expression.
Right. Right. So and I can't argue against the ability for someone to express, because I think that that's great. But I am also of the mind that if you want to write a story about something, I personally think it should be, like, invented by you. Like, if you don't own the rights to a character, then in my mind, I don't really see the point.
But then what about, like, I mean, then you come to so many other genres, like so many authors essentially write what their own families, and historical fiction is all about real life historical characters. They didn't make up, you know, Queen Victoria, mm-hmm. but there's lots and lots of historical stories about it, you know, so it's, I don't know.
But you're not, like, taking anything away from the existing canon.
Yeah, but I think you might be injecting ideas that don't necessarily exist there.
Well, I guess I'm still struggling with the problem with keeping the canon separate from the headcanon or the fan fiction.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just a function of being really mired in fan fiction, and my engagement with fandom has always had that component. So it's never stopped me from spending a lot of money on
it's so true.
Entertainment, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. like, and in fact, fan fiction has really drawn me to new things. In fact, so in a way, it's supporting my fandom habits.
Yeah. I think another thing that fan fiction can do really well, because it's not licensed and because it's not making money, is doing crossovers between publishers. Like, how awesome would it be to have a story about what Storm and Batwoman teaming up would be like, you know? That kind of thing is a common.
I just saw a great Tumblr post about like, how would Storm handle Sharknado? So maybe she should team up with Aquaman.
That'd be amazing.
Oh, yeah. Dear. Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong. I think crossovers like that are fun, but I think this may simply just come down to the fact that I personally do not enjoy stories like that. Like, I don't see a lot of fun in them. Like, I don't care how Batman would interact with Gambit. I love Batman and I love Gambit, but that, to me, those worlds don't exist because the canon doesn't follow that line. You know, so maybe I'm just not imaginative. Maybe that's the biggest problem here.
Well, I think that, like, I don't know, doesn't it ever bother you to think about the fact that, like, there are all of these perspectives on these characters that you are invested in, but you will never know about them because the publishers have decided that they're not worth supporting? So basically, these publishers have decided what's worthwhile to have in the canon, and they have somehow convinced you that these pre-selected ideas are what you should like.
Yeah, this is what's real. This is what the real Batman is. Even though the real Batman is not even just different throughout the decades, but is completely different across different lines of Batman currently ongoing. And yet somehow that is, yeah, it's a very sold notion that this is what counts versus all this other stuff.
But that doesn't bother me because I think that there's like an achievement in the ability to write that character, you know?
I but have why written is it less some spectacular fan fiction that I think could go up against any publisher chosen author. I really do. I think that there are creators out there who just, you know, I don't think that you can measure talent or quality of contribution by the paycheck, you know, who's signing your paychecks, because there are so many factors that go into these choices other than like talent and quality of contribution.
I understand that. I think my thought about it is still just like, I understand that there are many, many talented writers out there who would like to write these characters, but what's stopping them from writing these characters in the first place, I guess? You know,
Exactly. Like, I have zero interest in writing professionally because there's other things that I'd rather do for a career, but for fun as a hobby, oh absolutely.
I would never want someone to tell me I couldn't make the characters do what I want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can see
from
that
all accounts being a writer at the big two isn't a, you know, great life.
Have you guys ever seen, or I guess maybe just Kate, any non-big two fan fiction? I have read some pretty fun WCDIV fan fiction. For example, a Mean Girls AU.
Oh my God.
In which Woden's helmet is so big because it's full of secrets and Amaterasu is too straight to function.
That sounds amazing and I need to read it. You should.
It's pretty
send
funny.
The link.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't. And honestly, the vast majority of the fan fiction I read isn't for comics, it's for literature and TV, and, you know, movies.
Yeah.
Mostly books, mostly Harry Potter and Game of Thrones. Let's be honest with ourselves.
But, yeah, MCU for me.
I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I have read a lot of fan fiction before. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I would never, ever in my entire life sit down and read these things. Because when, you know, before the Harry Potter books came out, I was all about reading fan fiction. And about Harry Potter, like, 5 or 6 and 7 before those books came out, I would sit
exactly.
and read, like, no, I would read, like, these 10,000 word long fan fictions or more, you know, like, multi-chapter, like 20, 30, 40 chapter fan fictions. Mm-hmm. And eventually I realized that these aren't the characters, though. Like, whatever this story is doesn't matter because the books are going to come out and they're going to tell the story.
But they matter if they matter to you.
Yeah, can't they both matter?
I guess, but ultimately, like, it's just an alternate dimension that has no implications or no actual outcome that ties into the story that came out and is published and is like stamped as the Harry Potter story.
I know, but I hate to be the one to break this to you, but Harry Potter isn't real.
I totally understand that. And in that point, that's fine with me, but there is like a cohesive story that goes from beginning to end and tells that tale. And yes. Anything else is
extra goodness.
I guess, but if it's supposed to take place at the same time of the actual books, then like they're technically not true and not real. And no, I realize that we're talking about fiction here, but that's where I like it loses me, because it's like ultimately another book, another comic, another story is going to come out that could tell this same story, but in the actual cinematic printed, you know, stamp signed delivered version.
Okay. So the vast majority of fan fiction, right, for at least for books that I've read, mm-hmm. has been filling in gaps in story. So when we skip 6 months and now it's summer or now it's, you know, that kind of thing, and it's telling the stories about that time, or it's telling backstories of characters that are minor characters. And you can't say that that stuff then is totally negated, because when it's done in, by a licensed thing, like we're doing with the Star Wars miniseries right now, everyone goes, oh, okay, that's part of the continuum. We're just going back and filling in these things, like about Poe Dameron or whatever his name is right now, and the little...
BB-8.
The stuff about what Darth
oh
Vader
my God.
Was doing.
I know,
exactly.
Hey, what the hell?
I love him.
Right,
love
and
him.
So his stories don't just not matter because they're going back and filling in a gap. It's that...
Or something totally off story. Like, why can't we have just, like, a little ficlet about Poe Dameron, like, chilling in a bar and, like, being cool and singing karaoke? I don't know. Like, just fun stuff that is, like, technically in character but has no bearing on the main story. Just, like, just to extend your experience of the characters.
Yeah, and that's the big thing, is that you, for the same reason you were reading Harry Potter fan fiction before the books came out, is you just want more. And it's not that it means anything or has anything other than it's filling in a need for entertainment and being with those characters.
The thing that bothers me about it, though, is that it was then overwritten, you know? Like, it was then negated, you know? I mean, but back to your point, though, about, like, the side stories, like, I think that's all fun and great, but it's ultimately, like, it's not a part of the story to me. Like, I guess that's just how I see it. It's not part of the story that's being told about the character. Well, no, like Poe Dameron, the comic is to me part of the Star Wars story, right?
Because it's licensed, right?
Because it's, yeah, it's being published, it's being sanctioned, it's being kept in track, in line with a continuity that I can follow and I can trace back. Whereas fan fiction is just running wild, and there is
no
limitation.
So, like, all of it is.
I wrote a fan fiction of it's basically an extension of the post-credit scene in The Winter Soldier when Bucky goes to the Smithsonian. I literally just extend the scene for a few hours. It totally fits into the movies that come afterwards. It doesn't it doesn't do anything to disrupt the MCU canon. I did a lot of research. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I really, like, did my best to interrogate the situation and the character and, like, really analyze it and like, the whole... And to fill in this seam as seamlessly as I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, like, not all fan fiction is disruptive or transgressive or, like, rewritten later by the canon. Sometimes it fits in.
Yeah, and I have to say that you can't possibly, it's never been an issue for me, but you can't possibly be the only person who feels that way, Mike, because you can specifically filter on a lot of fan fiction websites stories that stay in canon and stories that don't. And so a lot of people, like Tia's saying, go really, really out of their way to do all their research and make sure it stays in canon. So if they're filling in a gap between issues or a scene that and just fleshing it out, that's exactly what they're doing. And it's just like, when you go back, whether with a licensed book and you're fleshing it out. But the big difference is that, you know, the ultimate, you know, white dudes at the top didn't say this is the one.
And I mean, obviously there is some of it is written better than others. I mean, that's 90% of fan fiction is, like, barely readable because,
I would say 99% of books that are published are terrible and movies that are come out are terrible. Like, this is most media is trash. And then there's the select stuff that you like. No, come on, look at all the stuff that, like, I don't know. That's personal soapbox, totally unrelated. But yeah, the reason that people there's, you know, we have classics is because those are the few that things that rose to the top and are still good. Like, the reason we have certain comics from the 90s that are still being reread today is because those were the really good things and everything else was not as good. That is obviously an arguable point, but you know what I'm saying? Like, when we have a 24/7 media cycle and, like, there's stuff on TV all the time, most of what's on TV is garbage, or at least is not for you. Like, in your own personal stuff is not the stuff that you enjoy. And that's how come people like things like Netflix so much, because then you can just watch the stuff you really like whenever you want. And I think that's the same thing for fan fiction. And it's how a lot of people are figuring out their writing chops. It's really good practice.
You know, and going back to Mike's point about it being a problem for publishers, you know, it sometimes can be a problem for people who then go on to become published authors of their own original work. I'm thinking of Cassandra Clare and the like complete shit show that was the Draco trilogy, and people like really freaking out about thinking that she plagiarized from like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and all of these different sources. Mm-hmm. And there was this huge campaign against her, and she got like involved and was threatening legal action. I mean, it was like this huge drama. She actually changed her pen name for when she published the Shadowhunter books because it was such a big problem. And a lot of people refused to read the Shadowhunter books because they're like, oh, it's just thinly veiled Draco trilogy or whatever. But like, it can be a problem and it can get out of control. Like, it is definitely something that you have to be careful about and cite your source. Like, I like to think of
sure
it as a research paper.
Make sure you're not getting paid for it, because if you get paid for it, that's just plagiarism.
Well, and cite your sources.
Yeah, as soon as you start, like, there is this whole thing with the what is, again, you know, this reiterates my most media is crap thing, the whole 50 Shades of Grey thing being, you know, Twilight fan
fiction. Oh, God, yeah.
And
is
I'm like,
that
that's an example
true?
That instantly comes
oh,
to
yeah,
mind
that's
for
true.
Me.
That's,
yeah.
That's
it,
actually
that's how
true.
It started.
Yep.
Okay.
Not a ringing endorsement for fan fiction, but that
except
is true.
Except, you know what? I would like to bring up the point that fan fiction is a safe space for people to explore alternate sexualities in a way that they don't feel free to do in their real lives. And that's very valuable, even if the thing that results from their experimentation is a pile of crap.
That's mm-hmm. true. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
and clearly it was a pile of crap that resonated with a whole lot of people.
Yeah, there's something. Yeah. All right. Well, I to try to, you know, not be so argumentative anymore, I guess. If for those of you who are out there who are interested in fan fiction or would like to read some good fan fiction, I may be going to ask Kate and T to maybe give me some links after the show. But if you two could recommend like a website or two or something that you usually go to find fan fiction, because by no means am I right about this, because I quite honestly just think it's my personal taste. I'm just not into this. And if you are, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I just want to make that clear, because I definitely still like Kate and Tia, and they read this stuff and write this stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's fantastic. But if you two could recommend any websites or places where you get good fan fiction or fan fiction that you enjoy, whether it's good or bad, what would you think of off the top of your head?
Archive of Our Own.
Archive of Our Own. Okay. And what's the best thing that you've read off of that?
My site. Favorite author is named Owlet.
Okay.
Yeah, like little owl, Owlet. She has an amazing series of Bucky and Captain America fan fiction that more or less fits like into MCU canon, and then it starts to go off the rails a little bit because we've all decided that Age of Ultron never happened, which, you know,
yeah
like is the better choice, trust me.
Sure.
It is not necessarily slash. She has like a sort of side slash that she wrote that you could apply to the main works, or you could just disregard it, so it's not intrusive at all. And she also has a really great Star Wars one called Generational Mistakes, and it's basically like Kylo Ren and Leia trying to like figure out how to be in the same room together after all of the horrible things that happened.
Oh, good.
It will make you literally like throw your device across the room and scream.
Fun. Kate, what about you?
Well, Tia stole my thunder. That is also my go-to website, but I also gotta say, like, a lot of stuff I find is just straight on people's Tumblrs.
Okay.
Or whether it's on their Tumblr or not, a lot of people will put together a Tumblr post of their favorite stuff, and so it's links to different things, especially for certain types of fan fiction, if you will. So like putting together a collection of these are my favorite things about Ramsay Snow, if with like his backstory, although why anyone would want more Ramsay Snow in their life, I don't know.
Yeah.
But some people must, because it's there. So I don't have a particular favorite go-to author, because I tend to like read like if I find someone I like, then I read all their stuff, and then I read the stuff that is like linked to theirs, more like the stuff that they're suggesting or clearly reading and stuff like that, and then kind of not go back. I kind of hop from lily pad to lily pad, which is probably bad. I should probably check people out and keep track of them more, but mm-hmm. that is just not what I do. So
cool. No, that's totally fine. I think like obviously you're consuming a lot and probably helping these people say oh look, I had more views on my stuff, and so that's great.
Tumblr is also great for fan art. I'm a big fan of the especially the gender bent heroes and stuff, like gender bent JLA and stuff, because female Batman is awesome.
Yeah, Tia gave or yeah sent us a link before we started recording today to a Kevin Wada DeviantArt site where he like reimagined some of the X-Men in like some very fashionable outfits, which I'll put in the show notes, and maybe some other links to other things that we've seen
I threw a link in there on our document for you to check out of this too, so
I'll definitely grab that too.
And you can always tweet at us. Kate and I will happily make any recommendations that you like. If you want to just tweet the I Read Comic Books podcast.
And I will just hijack the account and I will just scream no at you with a series of GIFs.
We will tie Mike up, duct tape his mouth, and throw him behind a cabinet to sure we answer all of your questions.
Well, this has been my last I Read Comic Books. It's been nice knowing you, Internet.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Oneself and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Oneself on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/oneself, and you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.com. Shout out to Potter and Family, a collection of podcasters and their podcasts of almost any topic you could imagine. If you're looking for new shows, check out the Potter and Family hashtag on Twitter and support small podcasts like us. You can find more of this podcast at our website, ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. Remember, if you enjoy this show, tell someone about it. Rate us online. Write to us. If you're looking for some fan fiction recommendations, or if you want to recommend one to us, hit us up at ircb@destroythesybe.org. You can also find the entire podcast team on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. And don't forget, you can join and spark conversations over on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
So Tia, I don't know what your setup's like, but for my kitty to keep her quiet during the podcast, I have gotten in the habit of turning on a heating pad for her before the show, and it's like she's drugged. It's great. she's not moving or mewing.
Lydia, I only see her on the weekends, and she is literally Velcroed to me the entire time. So she does not care. You. Yeah, she's like, open this door right now.
Yep. Okay, that's different then.
Usually she's in here with me, but she just like is good and curls up.
We have opposite kitties. Mine is a huge fluff ball of a long-haired cat.
Oh yeah, Liddy not so much.
But Zoe's markings make her look eternally pissed, so kind of has that bad girl vibe too. So
Lydia is literally Finks from Mirror.
Except for that's awesome.
I forgot to mention that I read issue 4, but I also didn't want to get into it because I don't know what the fuck happened, except that Finks is now a Sphinx, like, and a guardian.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna pick that up this week and then never got to the shop because I had guests over. So
I think that it's at a point that I'm just gonna need to wait and read them all straight through.
Yeah. What series is this?
Mirror.
Oh, right.
Is it going past this first arc? I mean, it ends at 5. I'm pretty sure they put the kibosh on it, but
because it was originally part of Eight House,
yeah. But it was originally started as an ongoing. It wasn't going to be a mini, but I think they're just going, nah, that didn't work.
I don't think anything that was conceived as Eight House is an ongoing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been.
Shoot, then I'm not remembering correctly.
No, because they're basically four or five or six issue like minis that are
for everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
They've been totally different creators for every arc, and it's not the same characters or anything. It's I'm not even quite sure how they're woven together.
And then.
Yeah, Eight House is ongoing. Yeah,
the whole thing's confusing. I actually like had a talk with my like shop person about this that we just don't understand how it works. But like, is it the same universe? I don't know. It's confusing.
It is, but I'm not sure how it's tied together.
Yeah. We mostly agreed that it was tied together by the weird, not good lettering.
I feel like I don't even care about the lettering because the art is just so beautiful.
But it's so jarring. It's so jarring with the beautiful art. It's like worse because of the art being so good. Like if the art was bad, it wouldn't be such a problem. But you know what I mean? Like when you have these beautiful watercolors and then the like supercomputer fonts, you're just like, no. Okay, how much do letterers even cost?
that's a good question.
I can't imagine it's that much. They're all starving, right? So, okay, Mike, you like Divinity. So, like, I just can't get past the fact, like, he has the exact, like, orphanage experience of any that you would expect for any white Russian dude. And you're like, we're going to not even address this at all? Because I'm like, I obviously didn't live through Soviet Russia, but I know that they had as many race issues as we did. And yeah. So you're talking like what the like 50s and 60s and stuff, and yeah, we're just going to pretend he's another little white boy in the orphanage and that has nothing to do with why he has no connections and why he's picked and like
what?
Whoa. Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to like get her to calm down, but she does not want to be held at all. Hold on. Well, you guys keep
No, yeah, that's fine. I did find that kind of weird, like that they like injected like you know, a person of color into the story just to kind of like make it a story about a person of color, but
didn't actually write the character to be a person of color. You know what I mean?
Like, well, at the same time, okay, like it's not like this character would necessarily have, you know, the same backstory or like history as, you know, someone growing up in as a, you know, an African American. You know, they're not going to have like this. I grew up in, you know, in poverty or something like that, or I grew up from rich parents who had, you know, had to struggle to in order to give me a good life, which is right. the two tropes that we typically hold on to for someone as a person of color, particularly black people, right?
Right.
So,
but we're still talking about the 50s and 60s where he's growing up, right? Even if it's Russia, they still were racist. And then, like, not addressing, like, not even, like, if you're in an orphanage and you're, I don't know. I just, the fact that we just completely glaze over the issue and yet try and say, like, oh, we're having this person, it's about this person of color. Like, you kind of completely ignore, like,
but
he had the exact same experiences as every other kid in his, you know, orphanage kind of setup, right? Which...
Yeah,
maybe okay. Today, but even today, I don't think that would be.
But then but I feel like it sounds to me like you're asking for a story about race, and I don't think that the story is about race.
No, you're right. It's not. I don't know. Maybe I also just didn't like. So I didn't know who any of the teen people were when I read this book, and so when showed like issues 1 and 2, I was pretty on board. And then when they show up, I'm like, what the hell is even happening?
Well, yeah,
you have to read The Valiant.
Yeah, when I was reading it, Nick was. I kept texting Nick. I was like, I know who Livewire is because I read some of Harbinger, but. I was like, I really don't know much about EXO, and I don't even know who this, like, military team is. He's like, well, he's like, you can kind of ignore it. I was like, I don't really think so, man.
Right? Like, they become issues 3 and 4, and I'm just like, I don't know or care about any of you, and I don't know. And then I think if I went back and read it knowing more about people, it might have been a better book, but...
Yeah, Divinity feels like a sequel to, you know, any of the books that had that team put together, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because it sounds like they're trying to make Divinity, the characters of Divinity, because it's not going to just be the guy. It's going to be, you know, the other two astronauts, I think, are going to come back as well. Obviously, Divinity, too. And I think that, like, they should have said, maybe you should read The Valiant, or maybe you should read part of Ninjak or something, because, like, I had no idea who most of those people were. So.
Well, they didn't have anything... I don't know. You know how Marvel do at the beginning of the book where you have like each character's little tiny, tiny mini bio? Like even something like that would have helped.
Yeah. I agree. Say what you will about Marvel's crazy crossovers. They usually try to at least give you some perspective.
Yeah, they do.
In a loose way, depending on the book. So, I don't know.
All right. Bad cats aside...
Yeah, I'm looking at that Kevin Wada link that you posted because I never actually clicked on it.
I cannot believe you would let this X-Men trend go by without checking it out. Shame on you.
I have never actually seen this. This is really interesting.
Oh my God, Mike.
Mostly because I really like X-23's outfit at one point. And I really love the whole Wanda and Pietro and I guess, that's going to be Wiccan and Speedy or whatever the fuck his name is.
I
love Magneto. He's so great. Like, he's a piece of shit, but I love him.
See, that's the thing. That's the thing I'm telling you about. Yeah, where people are like, this is my trash baby, and I love him.
I'm telling you, flawed characters, truly flawed characters, are 10 times more interesting.
Yeah. Like, well, these characters wouldn't be so flawed if they didn't have such harsh histories that stretch 30, 40 years, right?
Right.
Like, it's really hard to introduce a new character that has a broken backstory and is truly flawed when you're giving their strong backstory in, you know, an issue. It's like, it feels really forced, you know? Like, that the reason why X-23, to me, works as such a great character is because we got a whole mini-series documenting how fucking awful things were for her before she got free. You know?
Yes and no. I mean, think about the original, you know, how forced is it to kill off everyone's parents? Like, it's pretty forced.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we love orphans. Yep. That's what it comes down to. Because
issue is, I mean, my friend actually wrote an academic paper on this, because, I mean, you get this is the fairy tale thing, too. And the fact remains that, like, you can't have parents and be this extraordinary superheroic character because your parents would protect you from that. From that life. So you can't have parents and be a superhero.
Right.
That's why I'm not a superhero. Just so you guys know, I totally would have been.
Your mom won't let you.
Exactly. She kept me safe and it's all her fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not a superhero because I'm an asshole and a piece of shit.
Well, there's that.
Right. Every time Mike says that he's here with some amazing people, I'm like, well, one of them anyway.
I like you guys. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks.